Okay, welcome everybody to the 23rd Shiur in the series of 24 Shiurim. As I remarked at the end of the last Shiur, we're going to come to a summary in general and somehow sum up and give a comprehensive overview of all of the Shiurim. But before we do that, I want to make an important point, which I think it was discussed last time, but I think it needs a certain amount of emphasis. Beginning the last few times, actually the last two times, the last time, we began with the going called Inyan Abba Ve'ima. In other words, Adaf Kuf Memches, beginning on line 410, the going speaks about Abba Ve'ima. We notice that Abba Ve'ima, which are two patsufim in the Ari, were the means of expressing the fact that the creation is not only exists in an absolute sense, creation as nihilo of the entire world, but rather that every stage of creation and at every state of any natural process, whether it be in fact actually a natural process or a human process, the same methodology repeats itself. And that methodology is basically one thing that's called histalkus, hispashtos, going from the general to the specific. And that's what's called Abba Ve'ima. Now, what's Abba Ve'ima, according to the Goyim, is the pautzuf, which characterizes the main undercurrent, the methodology, the process by which all natural and human processes work, that takes one from the general to the specific. Abba, including incorporating the general, and Ima incorporating the specific. And the Goyim understood this both in terms of natural processes. He gave the metaphor with the sun and the plants, which shines, illuminates the world, and causes life to occur. And also, too, the Goyim spoke about this with respect to the human beings, how a person thinks, how a person relates to God, etc., etc. In other words, the natural process is one of Abba Ve'ima, his talkus for his pashtus, in the sense in which we discussed this over the entire series of Shiurim. Now, what's interesting is that, of course, Abba Ve'ima, which goes from the general to the specific, is from top down, right? Creation is from top down. So, in other words, what the Goyim, in fact, has elaborated on in Perek Yud, beginning from line 410, and until the very, very end, which is actually not to the end, but to where we got to, which is line 463, the Goyim has elaborated basically the top-down natural process of the world that goes from klal to prat, Abba Ve'ima. In fact, actually, though, before this, the Goyim focused himself on what man's function is. Even though man operates from klal to prat, that's how his emotions operate, as the Goyim spoke about Abba Ve'ira, that's how his mind operates, nonetheless, the function of man is to take the pratim, to examine the Rishimoy and go back to the beginning, go back to the Rotzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore what we get is we get two processes in the Goyim. We get what's called a cosmological process and we get an anthropological process. The cosmological process, which includes man, is basically goes from the general to the specific. The general to the specific. Whether we're dealing with natural processes, whether we deal with human emotions or the human ways of cognition. What man accomplishes, man's creations go from the prat to the klal. Man studies the details, and by studying the details, goes back, right, and understands basically what the initial rotzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was. He creates the parameters which give rise to the vision of the universe, which is in consonant with man's understanding and intellectual reasoning of the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, we have two processes in the Goyim. We have the cosmological, and I'm calling it the anthropological. Now, the reason I'm calling it cosmological is not only because these are appropriate terms, but actually, in fact, this is in fact the subject matter of a very book of Ernst Cassirer, which I mentioned at the end of the last Shia. This is the book, An Essay on Man, which was actually, I think Cassirer wrote it in English, because he was actually a German speaker. He was a German. Jewish, I don't think he was from. He's noted for many works, including a very famous, I think, three or four volume work, The Theory of Symbolic Forms. But Kassir was a what you would call a polymath. He knew everything. And I don't think he knew any Torah, but besides the Torah, he knew everything. And Kassir speaks about these two things, and I think it's worth it, Kedai, to actually read from Kassir. I told you yesterday I think I'll read from the 20s, but I think I'll start on page 817. So on page 17, I'm going to read from Kassir, who says the following thing. In the first mythological explanations of the universe, we always find a primitive anthropology side by side with a primitive cosmology. Derech Agav, if we look at the Chumash Bereishis, there's Perek Aleph and Perek Beis. Perek Aleph goes from the creation of the heavens and the earth until man. That's cosmological. Perek Beis really begins with man. Man davens, things grow, the focus is on man. So in Allah Kassira, right, we can understand, or Allah the Goyim, we can understand that Perek Aleph and Bereishis is none other than the cosmological picture. Perek Beis in the Chumash is the anthropological picture, and they're side by side. The question of the origin of the world is inextricably interwoven with the question of the origin of man. Religion does not destroy these first mythological explanations. On the contrary, it preserves the mythological cosmology anthropologically by giving them new shape and new depth. What the Goyim basically has done in terms of what I've spoken about, is he's taking the first two Pesukim of Bereishis and explaining in terms of Kabbalah. In other words, Perek Aleph and Bereishis is what? Is Simtzum Abba Ve'ima Klal Teprat. Perek Beis in Bereishis is anthropology. Man takes the details and creates transcendental syntheses, including Chet. Now, so says Kassir, henceforth, self-knowledge is not conceived as a merely theoretical interest. It is not simply a subject of curiosity or speculation. It is declared to be the fundamental obligation of man. So self-knowledge is important. Since the cosmological and the anthropological pictures go hand in hand, so, right, man becomes important within creation. And goes on Kassir and says, he says in Judaism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Christianity, we can observe the individual steps of this development. Now, the same principle holds good in the general evolution of philosophical thought. Okay? In its earliest stages, I'm on page 18 in Kassir, its earliest stages, Greek philosophy seems exclusively concerned with the physical universe. Cosmology particularly predominates over all the branches of philosophical investigation. This is the drasha that you'll hear on Hanukkah, that, you know, Yovan is Teva, Elohim, right? That's part of the truth, of course. It is, however, characteristic of the depth and comprehensive of the Greek mind that almost every individual thinker represents at the same time a new general type of thought. Beyond physical philosophy of the Milesian school, the Pythagoreans discover mathematical philosophy, while the Eleatic thinkers are the first to conceive of the ideal of the logical philosophy. However, goes on Kassir and says, right, that then we come to Socrates. Okay? Thus, it's the problem of man that we find the landmark separating Socratic from pre-Socratic thought. Socrates discovers the anthropological dimension. Socrates never attacks or criticizes the theories of his predecessors. Okay? He does not intend to introduce a new philosophical doctrine. Yet in him, all the former problems are seen in a new light because they are referred to in a new intellectual center. The problems of Greek natural philosophy and Greek metaphysics are suddenly eclipsed by a new question, which seems henceforth to absorb man's whole theoretical interest. In Socrates, we no longer have an independent theory of nature, an independent logical theory. We don't even have a coherent systematic ethical theory. Only one question remains: what is man? Socrates always maintains and defends the ideal of an objective, absolute universal truth, but the only universe he knows and to which all his inquiries refer to is the universe of man. His philosophy, bless the philosophy, is strictly anthropological. Okay, so he goes on and Kassir proves this thing, etc., etc. I'm not going to go through the entire book. I recommend the book for anyone who's interested in Bittul Torah, but in any case, so the fact is that through most medieval eras, no, man was at the center of the universe. There's no question about man's at the center of the universe. Now, this positioning of man at the center of the universe comes to an end with probably one of the most important, scientific revolution in history, and that's Copernicus. Okay? And that's what Kassir says on page 30. Well, first of all, beginning with Descartes, which you've spoken about in terms of the Arizal, right? We have new intellectual development. what is man is transformed and to speak race to a higher level. The important thing here is not so much the discovery of new facts, we are now page 30, as the discovery of a new instrument of thought, right? The cause instrument of thought. Now, for the first time, the scientific spirit in the modern sense of the word enters the lists. The quest now is for a general theory of man based upon empirical observations and on general logical principles. The first postulate of this new and scientific spirit was removal of all the artificial barriers that heretofore separate the human world from the rest of nature. In order to understand the order of human being, things, we must begin with a study of the cosmic order. In other words, man goes back to nature. And this cosmic order now appears in a wholly new light. The new cosmology, the heliocentric system introduced in the work of Copernicus, is the only sound and scientific basis for a new anthropology. Neither classical metaphysics, now this is very, very important, okay? Very important. Neither classical metaphysics, nor medieval religion and theology were prepared for this task. Both of these bodies of doctrine, however different in their method and aims, are grounded in a common principle. They both conceive the universe as a hierarchical order in which man occupies the highest place. In Stoic philosophy and Christian theology, man was described as the end of the universe. Both doctrines are convinced that there is a general providence ruling over the world, destiny of man. This concept is one of the basic results of Stoic and Christian thought. All this is suddenly called into question by the new cosmology. In other words, all of a sudden, man's claim to be the center of the universe has lost its foundation. You can see why they put Copernicus in the Cherem. All these guys in the Cherem. That was the church was so much against this. Man is placed in an infinite space in which his being seems to be a single vanishing point. He is surrounded by a mute universe, by a world that is silent to his religious feelings and whose deepest moral demands. It is understandable and it was necessary that the first reaction to the new conception of the world can only be a negative one, a reaction of doubt and fear. Even the greatest thinkers cannot free themselves from this feeling. And then he quotes Pascal in French, Le silence éternel de cet espace infini m'effraie. The Copernican system, I don't know what that means in French, the eternal silence of the infinite space, m'effraie. Anyway. The Copernican system became one of the strongest instruments of the philosophical agnosticism and skepticism which developed in the 16th century. Of course, man at the center of the universe right now. Who cares about man? In his criticism of human reason, Montaigne uses all the well-known traditional arguments of the system of Greek skepticism. Basically, Copernicus becomes a new kafira. And there's Arcus, I think there's a... They were actually good them. Actually, I think there's a truvi, the Shvus Yankov, the Shav Yankov, that says if a person believes that man is the earth is outside the universe, you're not Pekiras. So the Shvus Yankov, the Shav Yankov, what are these poiskim? Besides that, it's fine. Right, now. So, the question is, what do we do now? What do we do now? Now we know that man is not the center of the universe. Man is a speck. Insignificant. If man is not significant, so what do we say to this? How does religious thought deal with this highly diminished concept of man? Okay? Now, I'm sure many of your friends still feel that the earth is not the center of the universe. But I'm speaking, I assume, in these shirim to people who at least entertain a strong suspicion that the world isn't the earth is not the center of the universe. So, because of that, how do we answer this? Now, very interesting that Kassira understood this to be a religious crisis. We know that people were put in, excommunicated by the church for this. So, he calls this the new cosmology and says that there was a thinker. He says, turned an apparent curse of the new cosmology into a blessing. Now, who is this thinker? This thinker is Giordano Bruno. Now, I confess, I never read any of Bruno's work. But I'm going to read from Cassira on page 32. He says like this. Modern philosophy and modern science had to accept the challenge contained in these words. They had to prove that new cosmology, far from feebly obstructing the power of human reason, establishes and confirms its power. Such was the task of the combined efforts of the medical systems of the 16th and 17th centuries. These systems go different ways, but they're all directed towards one and the same end. They strive, so to speak, to turn the apparent curse of the new cosmology into a blessing. Giordano Bruno was the first thinker to enter upon this path, which in a sense became the path of all modern metaphysics. What's characteristic of the philosophy of Giordano Bruno is that here the term infinity changes its meaning. In Greek classical thought, infinity is a negative concept. See my shiur on the Mar Nevuchim, and we spoke about that in the last shiur. The infinite is the boundless or indeterminate. It has no limit and no form, and is therefore inaccessible to human reason, which lives in the realm of form and can understand nothing but forms. In this sense, the finite and infinite are declared by Plato to be the two fundamental principles which are necessarily opposed to one another. In Buddha's doctrine, infinity no longer means a mere negation or limitation. On the contrary, it means the immeasurable and inexhaustible abundance of reality and the restricted power of the human intellect. It is in this sense that Buddha understands and interprets the Copernican doctrine. This doctrine, according to Buddha, was the first step towards man's self-liberation. Man who lives in the world as a prisoner, with the narrow walls of a finite physical universe, he can traverse the air and break all the imaginal boundaries of celestial spheres, which have been created by a false metaphysics and cosmology. Now, if I asked you, dear students, listeners of the Shiurim, who did this for the last month? Who has emphasized the infinite power of the human intellect to traverse the boundaries of all of physical metaphysical ontology? It is none other than who? The Gaon. The Gaon represents the vital movement in ensuring the central place for man, not physically, but intellectually, in the universe. The Gaon is able to preserve the anthropological principle by infinitizing man's intellect and placing it at the very, very boundaries, the borders of the physical and spiritual worlds. None other than the Gaon. So, the fact is now, of course, the Gaon is in the 18th century. Well, it's in the 18th century. And, of course, the notion of Ein Sof already appears in Ariza. In other words, the first part of what Kassir is saying, that infinity was made mechubadik, was made something which was respectable, we see in the Ari, because the Ari already refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the Ein Sof. But the fact is, the liberating concept for man that allowed man to maintain the anthropological concept of creation in contradistinction or in conjunction with the cosmological concept is precisely the Gaon. By positing Yisrael v'Reisa, v'kut shabrichu chadu, and by enabling man to construct within his metaphysical system transcendental syntheses which determine the very ontological makeup of all physical and spiritual and moral reality, the infinity of man's intellect becomes the driving force behind the universe. And this is the important spiritual liberation which is achieved through the hashkafa, the shita, the ontology, the philosophy of the Gaon. So we see over here is that precisely the reaction which Kassira ascribes to, he calls it 16th and 17th century thinkers is actually none other than the derech, the way in which the Gaon dealt, in fact, actually with this problem. So, what we see over here, what we get, is the following scheme, which is very, very important. The fact is that history, certain intellectual history, works in two lanes. There are two movements. There's one movement in which, and I'm going to call it the cosmological movement and the anthropological movement, because this is all in the Gaon. There is one movement in which basically the universe becomes, let's put it this way, much more detailed and much more physical. Abba Ve'ima as a spiritual concept is expressed in all the sciences. As scientists probe deeper and deeper into the very basic and the more basic, the more and more basic constituents, either of matter or of energy or of the mind, as science unravels more and more details, then the human being becomes much more embedded within the physical universe, becomes much more absorbed into the cosmos. So basically, in other words, man, in a certain sense, becomes the ultimate detailed figure in the universe because he is composed of the details of every aspect of nature, whether it be physical, whether it be organic, whether it be the other types of details which describe the nature, the nature of the physical world in general and man in particular. In other words, also too, man, as man searches for the fundamental particles, basically, man's intellectual course brings them upon the consciousness of an ever more infinitely detailed picture of the universe and of himself. In which case, the actual tzua of man now becomes embodied in a detailed picture of reality, where man is further and further and increasingly being reduced to merely a facet of the natural world, and losing, according to many scientists, his unique transcending status. That's how we would understand this. That's the cosmological movement. On the other hand, though, in opposing the cosmological movement is the anthropological movement, right? Because, first of all, on one hand, this increasingly detailed picture of the universe is an expression of the infinite power of the human mind. You know, when man's mind conceives of much more complex and abstract conceptual models, which, while they discretize, make discrete his picture of the universe, they rest and they are based upon increasingly much more abstract, transcendental models which are further and further removed from the man's physical conception and sensual conception of the universe. So we have here somehow the imminence and transcendence of man actually following in inverse proportion. Man becomes, on one hand, increasingly imminent. Man becomes, on the other hand, increasingly transcendental. Therefore, we have the cosmological and anthropological principle as inversely related to each other, and each of them is moving in opposite directions with increased acceleration, increased velocity. Now, the fact is that this is really, in a certain sense, the Torah reaction, to what it views as the process of scientific achievement. As the vision of the world and of man becomes increasingly imminent in the scientific sense, Torah Hashkafa becomes increasingly transcendental. We spoke about many shiurim ago of the analogy between Kant and between the Goyin, the Chaim Volozhiner, and Chaim Soloveitchik. The fact is that this increasingly transcendental nature of the way in which the Torah is expressed, Torah is theorized, in fact, actually the halacha is in fact modeled, is not coincidental, but actually in a certain sense comes as a reaction and a liberating factor, a type of cosmological constant, to stave off the increasingly imminent and physical picture of man, which is the message of scientific reductionism. So the watershed and the liberating transcendence and infinitization of man is actually, in a certain sense, the Goyin. The Goyin is the person who, by making infinite and boundless man's intellect, and that was the Goyin's concept, not only man's intellect, but of the Torah too, then the Goyin is able to accommodate the modern scientific theories, which, on the other hand, make man to be much more insignificant. Now, what does, in fact, this is actually, in fact, the important place that the Goyin, in fact, serves in Jewish history. If we just even compare the Ramchal with the Goyin, we see that in the Ramchal, everything is from top down. Gili Yehudai is basically Hayashkacha b'Kadosh Baruch Hu, which is a consequence of where Kadosh Baruch Hu creates the world, directs the world. Man's bechira, man's intellect, is not actively involved in any aspect of creation, but rather his bechira is limited. He is b'Kadosh. He does bring Kadosh to the world through his mitzvahs, but the greater overall picture of the Ramchal, if you learn through the Das Tevunais with the Klolim or the Klach B'Zeh Chachma, is man as a spectator to the God-directed, divine-directed path where, in fact, God's yichud, God's unity, becomes more and more apparent in the world. So basically, God is the major character, man's on the side. Of course, the purpose of God's actions are actually for man. So man, according to Ramchal, probably Ramchal might believe that man stood at the center of the universe, but man said the universe is really a spectator for the great cosmic drama in which God is revealing the unity of himself with a capital H. In the Goyim, however, we can understand the picture is radically different. There is a process from top down that goes from Kalal and Prat, but the liberating, the changes that occur in the world, which bring man to spiritual liberation, occur exactly because of the incredible transcendence of man's intellect, which guides, in a certain sense, the divine intellect in conceptualizing the world, through which God is able to bring the world towards a greater perfection. So in other words, we see that even in the times of the Goyim to the Ramchal, which I don't think is less than 60, 70 years, we see this radical change in the concept, 60, 70 years
from the Ramchal to the Goyim.
Sorry, second Rabbi Sedley, the Ramchal was before the Goyim, this incredibly radical change in Hashkafa, which clearly places the center of gravity intellectually and spiritually on man as a key actor in also directing the divine direction and conception of the ethical and natural law of our world. So, in other words, this is really, in fact, the revolution that the Goyim accomplishes. Now, like I said before, this revolution began with the Arizal. And that's what Kassirah says. Kassirah speaks about Descartes. When I spoke about the Arizal, I also spoke about Descartes. Descartes was the first person who made the human mind to something which is separate from the physical world. That was Descartes. That was the Arizal. But it's actually this Giordano Bruno is the person who infinitizes man's intellect. I don't want to see that the Goyim is connected Bruno. Right? Chas v'shalom, we should compare a Litvish with an Italian. But in any case, the fact is that the role played by Descartes seems to be analogous with that which is played by the Arizal, but the Makom HaPatish, that which liberates and overcomes the seemingly anthropological deficiencies of the new science, is none other than the Goyim, who liberates man's mind. And of course, the philosophy of the Goyim, you know, has its heirs, of course, in Rav Chaim Voloshin, as we spoke about many times, even Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, as I spoke about, etc., etc., today. Okay, now, what I wanted to come in is exactly what does this leave us? We have this astounding intellectual picture and intellectual edifice, which is the Goyim has created. But where, in fact, actually, does it leave a person from an existential point of view? Namely, the major argument, objection to all this Lithuanian thinking is, where's the Tati? Where's the Tati? Where's the Father? Now, the Goyim did actually speak about Avinu Shebashamayim, but when he spoke about Shemayim, he just spoke about it in a philosophical, spiritual sense, that the Shemayim is called Abba, Avinu Shebashamayim. Even the concept of a Tati and Hibel for the Goyim becomes a conceptual concept, that the Shemayim has the quality of klal, of generality, which is called Abba. But Chas v'Shalom, there should be a Tati in Himmel. But the fact is, where in fact does all of this leave the spiritual dimension of a person? We all have to agree that there's a spiritual dimension of a person which in a certain sense has to, certainly has to complement, right, the intellectual edifice which allows us to understand the role played by thought, by Torah, and by science. Now, the fact is that Kassira actually also speaks about this, and actually he quotes from the very famous French mathematician and scientist called Pascal. Pascal, as we know, was a very, very important scientist, but the fact is that Pascal also, too, was a person who understood that man has a spiritual dimension, which, in fact, is other than that of reason. And as Kassira says on, right, that there's a mystery of man, right, which is, you know, which science cannot get to. And religion is expression of this mystery. So, and that's what he says on page 28. Kassira says, there is therefore only one approach to the secret of our human nature, that of religion. Religion shows us that there is a double man, the man before and after the fall. Man was destined for the highest goal, but he forfeited his position. By the fall, he lost his power, and his reason and his will were perverted. The classical maxim, know thyself, and understood, in his philosophical sense, says of Socrates, seemed only ineffectual, it is misleading and erroneous. Man cannot confide in himself and listen to himself. He has to listen, silence himself in order to hear a higher and true voice. Quote, what will become of you then, O man? You will search out what is your true condition by your natural reason. Know then, haughty man, what a paradox you are to yourself. Humble yourself, impotent reason. Be silent, imbecile nature. Learn that man infinitely surpasses man and hear from your master your true condition, which you are ignorant of. Listen to God. And actually, who he's quoting is quoting Pascal from his book, Pensées, Pensées means in French thoughts, chapter 10, section 1. Right? And Kassira says the following thing. What's given here is not meant to be a theoretical solution to the problem of man. Religion cannot offer such a solution. By its adversaries, religion has always been accused of darkness and incomprehensibility. But this blame becomes the highest praise as soon as you consider its true aim. Religion cannot be clear and rational. What relates is an obscure and somber story, the story of the sin and fall of man. It reveals a fact of which no rational explanation is possible. We cannot account for the sin of man, for it is not produced or necessitated of any natural cause, nor we can account for man's salvation. But this salvation depends on an inscrutable act of divine grace. It is freely given and freely denied. There is no human action, no human merit that we can deserve it. Religion, therefore, never pretends to clarify the mystery of man. It confirms and deepens this mystery. The God from whom it speaks is Deus absconditus, a hidden God. Hence, even in his image, man cannot be other than mysterious. Man also remains a homo absconditus. Religion is no theory of God and man of your mutual relation. The only answer that we receive from religion is that it is the will of God to conceal himself. Thus, God being concealed, every religion does not say that God is concealed is not true. Every religion which does not render a reason for this is not instructive. Ours does all of this. Verito est Deus absconditus. For nature is such that everything indicates that God laws both in man and out of man. Religion is therefore, so to speak, a logic of absurdity. For only thus can it grasp the absurdity, the inner contradiction, the chimerical being of man. And then he finally quotes again from Pascal. Certainly, this is from the Pensée. Certainly, nothing strikes us more rudely than this doctrine, and yet without this mystery, the most inconceivable of all, we are inconceivable to ourselves. And out of our condition takes a twist and turns in this abyss that man is more inconceivable without this mystery than this mystery is inconceivable to man. Now, what does it mean? I think it means the following thing. It is true that Litvisha, Lithuanian philosophy, as we've explicated it over the last 23 shiurim, is very somber and rational. It's a theoretical conceptual edifice, which in a sense has no character in and of itself other than a description of the magnitude, achievement, and potential of human reasoning. However, doesn't mean that here we have the entire picture. The demarcation and primitization of the rational structure of what is not only does it explain what is, but helps to explain, conversely, what isn't. This is a very, very important thing. The intellectualization of reality, the world, and man's relationship to God does not, in a sense, in any way, do away with man's personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But all it does is to say, is that delineates those areas through which man can sense a mystery. And it's this mystery, this existential mystery, which he calls an absurdity, which in a certain sense represents, fills in that which reason does not describe and does not pretend in any way to communicate. Now, let me explain this in a little bit more detail. The understanding of the Goyim when it began was Klal Gadol Bateir. I'm going back to the second line in the Asar Klalim. The Kol Mashi Dibul Kol Mekubalim Kol Atira Kula Kol Beretzoni Yisbarach, etc., etc. Lo Dibul Chas V'Shom, they didn't speak of Kodesh Baruch and of himself. But they spoke about how man conceives him. And the way this is understood, classically, certainly we spoke about this from the Arizal, is that there's two aspects of God. There's an aspect of God which is unknown to man, beyond man, that man doesn't relate to, man cannot even conceive it. And there's an aspect of God to which man relates to, the Hamish of God, the Tati in Himmel. The Hamish. So, basically, the Pashtus, the Ari speaking about, and those who followed, the Ramchal, down to the Balatanya, up to the Balatanya, is that there's a Hamish of God and a Kaltika. There's a Hamish Ebishter and a Kalta Ebishter. The warm God, the personal God, is the God to whom we relate to. That's after the Tzimtzum. God beyond us, we don't relate to in a personal way. The God who reveals himself to us is the God to whom we relate to in a Hamish way, in a personal way. That's the personal God. That's the Pashtus of the Ari, the Pashtus of the Balatanya, Pashtus of the Ramchal. And God Taka is a Tati. Is a Tati. However, I want to claim in the Goy, and I'm saying this is a very big Chiddush in the Goy, it's a Lifish Chiddush. The God that we relate to in the Goy is the God of reason, the God of logic. Where's the personal God? The personal God, in a certain sense, is the God who's beyond us. Why is he the personal God? He's the God of mystery. He's the Deus Absconditus. He's the God that gives man a sense of existential crisis, angst, dichotomy. He's not the Hamish God that man feels as a Tati, but it's the sense of the tremendisus, the tremendity of existence, which weighs upon man, which gives man a sense of spirituality. This is the quote-unquote personal God of the Goy. The personal God of the Goy is not the Tati, but the personal God of the Goy is the spiritual truth that a person feels from his intuition and his understanding that his rational understanding of the world is limited, cannot provide him with the ultimate human answers. The gulf between man and God becomes the Litvisha Tati. The Hasidic Tati gives me a kush. He hugs me. He's warm. The Lifishatati makes me feel alone. That's the expression of the personal Lifishagot. You got that? It's the Deus as absconditus. It's the God removed from reality. That's what gives me my existential spiritual dimension. And dear readers, this one thinker who I believe agrees with me, and that's none other than Rabbi Shel Yisrael, Yoshe Be'el Soloveitchik. If a person will really scrutinize Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings, whether it be the Lonely Man of Faith, whether it be Halachic Man, and certainly will it be the forthcoming series of lectures on Genesis, which Amidrashim is going to be coming out in several months, where yours truly has added his humble footnotes, you will see that the personal Lithuanian rational dimension of loneliness, of existential despair, of angst, of contradiction, paradox, of tremendium, is none other than the Lithuanian version of the Hasidic Tate. This represents the important existential dimension of the Gaon. So we have here an incredible thing. What the Gaon has really done is taken the Arizal and flipped him inside out. He flipped him inside out. And what the Gaon has done and created a system of logic, a system of rational conceptualization, but a system which only heightens the vacuum which gives a man a sense of loneliness, of humanity, and a need to search out for this hidden God. That's the legacy, the existential legacy, which the Gaon has left to his Talmid and to his students, to those who humbly and faithfully follow him and understand the depths of his thought. Now, so this is something, though, which, you know, people don't want to know about. People run to religion. People run to Judaism. People run to do tshuva because they're looking for a tati, looking for warmth. It's very, very few people who run to Judaism because their existential angst is not satisfied. They're looking for answers, and they're looking for meaning to their existential crisis. Are we searching for warmth, or are we searching for meaning? Or are we searching for the meaning of the lack of meaning? Or are we searching somehow for a handle on this lack of meaning, or to sense this loss, this meaningless existence, which we sense, but we can't clarify or make explicit within our religious knowledge? These are the two paths which people take. The Lifshitz path is that man is constantly confronted with existential crisis. The rumblings of the human existential position and the hidden God which adds fuel to his hiddenness and to the dichotomy, disparity which man feels between his existence and the ultimate cosmological answers, these are the things which drive the Lithuanian man of faith. And I think that these are the things which actually, in a certain sense, describe the works of Yoshe Be'el Soloveitchik. They're not religious works in the Hamish sense. They are works of existential anxiety in the Lithuanian sense. But this is not to mean that these are works in which we're espousing a certain amount of religious skepticism, chas v'shalom. They're an expression of the deepest longings of man for a God, which ultimately he feels he cannot intellectually understand. And these longings are the deep recesses of spiritual, existential man's condition, which are the byproduct of such a rational system like that of the Goy. So therefore, what we've done today is, in a certain sense, we've presented not only a summary of the Goy's rational scheme, but what we've done actually is we've presented an exposition of the existential process, which in fact actually is issued, consequently follows from this rational scheme. The Goyin ends his shiurim on Daf Kufnun, page 150, Kufnun, and he begins, he ends his shiurim in line 463. And he speaks about the Shem Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei. What's the Shem Hashem? V'chein hu say Yud. Once again, Yud Kei Vav Kei. What does Yud Kei Vav Kei represent? Yud Kei Vav Kei Shem Hashem. The Tala Tera Kula, like the Ramban says in his Hakdama to the Torah, it's actually Zoya, is names for God. The most general name is Yud Kei Vav Kei. So therefore, Yud Kei Vav Kei, in a certain sense, has to span all of reality. So says the guy, V'chein usoy Yud, usoy Abba Tipa B'chlolos. Yud is Abba, which is Chlolos. U'kshima Tipa L'dal Rucha Yisa Oilam, soy Dalet Nasehe. So it's interesting, when the Yud connects with the Abba Rucha Yisa Oilam, so you have a Dalet, and then you have a little line underneath that, that's the Hey. That's ima. V'zeh soy yud kei abba v'ima. V'sham nistayim b'chinas pratis v'nasas v'ah. So like this. So they're like this. Now, abba v'ima, of course, is the theoretically, the prat that comes from the klal. But once the prat is realized, the plan, the detailed plan is realized, now it becomes a reality in the world. What happens is that now, in the beginning of life, becomes a vav. So basically, right, the dalet and last hey is basically the hey, which is in fact olam hazeh, and that's soid havaya. It was. Havaya represents the final protius that comes from Vav, from Leda, which is birth. And then it, the course of its life is one of protius. So that's also the same thing too. The Vav becomes the inside of the hair of the Dalet. And that's finally Soid Havaya. That's the entirety of reality. So reality basically is from top to bottom, Yud Kei Vav Kei. Okay, that's how the going ends. Because the guy that says he's described everything, and everything, the certain sense metaphorically, can be understood in terms of the scheme of the name Yud Kei Vav Kei. Okay, now, so says the guy, but the guy finishes here, 466. The four more lines, At Kan Matzasi, the person who wrote this, who says, up until here, and this up till here is what I found. Yechaka dechtav akdama lahavid atzimshim hirichta b'seif atos koydish k'savim yukhas labino hagor. After that, there's a hakdama, it was written a hakdama introduction to understand the tzimtzum that appears in the seif atos koydish, which is also b'yukhas to the goyim. As yasidah harav b'nachem mendel. B'nachem mendel from Shklov was the person who edited this. V'sham hakol loshin hagor be'atzmai, and there everything is loshin of the goyim himself. And this Dhamma above was not written there. Okay, this ends the Ksav Yad, which was right, and there's, if you look here in I don't go into this, but there's Rabbi Avivi, Professor Avivi wants to in fact actually claim that because I see that there are one or two details over here that might have been subject to the editor, but I don't want to go into the scientific aspect of that. But the fact is that what we have here is the final vision of reality, both cosmological and topological, right, as by the Goyim. Now, we finished the Goyim. This is the, in fact, actually, the end of Shir 23. Now, I could go on and on. As you've noticed, I have ability to go on and on and on. Originally, these shiurim were intended to be live. And the live aspect of the shiurim somehow petered out. And of course, the last shiurim have been broadcast from an undisclosed place in Yerushalayim. And of course, there's no way to get to me live. However, I feel that for the purposes of completion, or perhaps tashlumim, or pitsuyim, to the listener, then maybe it might be good if we somehow can interact in terms of questions and answers. What I'd like to do for the next class, which is the final class, 24, is maybe if you could somehow email in some of your questions, if you have any important questions that you want to ask on anything I've said over the last 24 hours, 24 shiyum, can I get Chav Dalet, 24 hours be a mama? And maybe I could address them, read off the interesting questions, and address them in the next broadcast. Now, if some of you would like me actually to go on further and elaborate on a on another issue related to the Goyim, I'm happy to do that too. After all, you are the audience and you can demand what you expect me to do. So in other words, I'm leaving, in fact, actually, we do actually a little bit of both. We may divide up a half hour. In any case, at the website,
admin at hashkafacircle.com.
You can all email in any of questions that you have, which you'd like me to answer, and I will devote the next class to that. Or you can email in any of your editorial comments, meaning that you would like me to actually expound upon something. Or we can do some comics combination, a little bit of both. So that I'm leaving up to the reader. We'll wait over the next day or two and see what your response is, and that will decide the format of the next year. Until then, everybody should be well. Kol tov.